It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at some of the most significant changes coming to K-12 education as a result of new legislation and the state budget.
First, Wisconsin Democrats elected a new party chair this past weekend at their state convention in Milwaukee. Martha Lanning, a community activist from Sheboygan, won with 53% of about 1,350 votes, the largest turnout in two decades.
Her election comes after 6 years of party leadership by Mike Tate, who did not run for re-election. Those 6 years were marked by repeated losses to Republicans in races for governor and the state legislature.
Martha Lanning joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Well, since 2009, Wisconsin Democrats have had rough going of it. They've lost both chambers of the state legislature. They've lost in gubernatorial elections three times to Scott Walker. They were unable to unseat two Republican-backed incumbents on the state Supreme Court. What reasons do you see for that track record?
Well, I think that we need to create a better message that resonates with our voters and inspires them to get out to the polls. And I think to deliver that message in our communities, we need to be sure that we have strong county parties, strong grassroots organizers that understand what our messaging is, understands what we offer the state of Wisconsin, and that they're getting that message out year-round.
Now, do you think the Democratic Party in Wisconsin made a mistake by running Mary Burke against Governor Walker in 2014? This is something that has come up occasionally.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a mistake. I think Mary Burke was a strong Democrat that believes in the progressive values that we had. I think that we need to be sure that we're getting our message out, though, and ensuring that people understand what the Democratic Party is offering. And I think that's probably the mistakes that we made, is that we weren't getting a message out there that was really resonating with the voters and showing how Democrats would be making better choices for working people in Wisconsin.
Is part of the problem maybe that there was not, to voters, a coherent message coming out of the Democratic Party, that there wasn't clear branding about what the Democrats stood for in Wisconsin?
I definitely feel that way. You know, when I was campaigning for state chair, I would often go around the state and I'd say, what is a Democrat? What does a Democrat stand for? And people had a pause. And I said, that's our problem, is that we need to come together as a team and we need to develop a really strong message. And I believe Democrats stand for strong communities. We believe in investing in public education, which is the heart and soul of our community. We believe in community-minded, strong business that offers great jobs so that our families and in the community can, you know, take care of their own families, but can also contribute to our economy and help grow that economy. We want to be sure that businesses thrive, but not on the backs of our labor. We want to be sure that we have community-minded business that's not greedy. And when we have all those things and we're investing in education and having opportunity for all and responsibility for others and fairness, that's when we're going to have a strong Wisconsin.
Now, Democrats have been accused by Republicans of using divisive rhetoric, of not offering alternatives to Republican policy. What new ideas do Democrats have to offer the state of Wisconsin?
Well, I think the issue for me is that we need to look at this budget, for example. This budget is a disaster, and it has been created entirely by the Republicans and Governor Walker. You know, we're watching states like Minnesota with a $1 billion surplus, and the budget here is over $2 billion. And all we keep hearing about is how we have to cut important things in our community, like public education. You know, we don't have the money to take care of the roads, which are very important to our businesses in the state. What would we do differently? Well, to start off with, I wouldn't do an unfair thing like eliminating taxes or all but eliminating taxes on manufacturers. I think manufacturers use our roads and use our court systems and have policing and fire protecting their facilities. And I think they, just like everybody else in the community and businesses like construction, tourism, retail, they pay taxes. Why shouldn't manufacturers? That'd be over $500 million added back to our budget if we would just reinstate taxes on farming and manufacturing.
Now, the budget you're talking about is the product of a Republican majority legislature and a Republican governor. Is it possible that the demographics politically in Wisconsin have swung to the right and that Wisconsin now is more conservative than it used to be?
I don't believe it has. I mean, I believe that that the Republicans have shown in past elections that their message was resonating. I don't always think that their message was very honest. For instance, I ran for state senate last year in 2014. And, you know, my message was saying that the upcoming budget was going to have a $1.7 billion deficit because that's what the Fiscal Bureau had reported, and I felt that was accurate, while Governor Walker and my opponent were saying it was going to have a $500 million surplus. We need to hold our legislators accountable. You know, that's what they claimed was going to be there. And within 30 days of the election, Governor Walker said it was a $2.2 billion deficit. You know, that it, we need to be sure that our political leaders are getting out honest information and being fair.
We're talking right now with Mary Lanning, new chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, and looking ahead on that. And Mary, looking in the rearview mirror...
Martha Lanning.
I'm sorry, Martha Lanning.
Sorry.
Looking in the rearview mirror, some Democrats have been asking why more wasn't done to promote the Democratic agenda when Democrats had control of the governor's seat and the legislature. So looking back, do you see missed opportunities?
Well, I think that's one of the things about Democrats is that we are a group that likes to work together, and I think we're much more willing to work across the aisle. And there certainly are some Democrats out there that felt like when we had the advantage that we didn't capitalize on it. What I want to look forward to is that what we're going to do in the future, and I think, again, it's talking about fairness, you know, ensuring that in 2020, once we've regained some of the legislature that we need to regain, that we ensure that we change it so that Iowa, the way the technique that they're using in Iowa to create the lines for our districts is used here. You know, we need to start to do some of the things that need to happen to prevent some of the unfairness that's occurring right now.
How optimistic are you about regaining some Democratic seats?
I'm very optimistic. I think, you know, I think the polls are showing that Governor Walker is losing credibility and popularity in our state, and he's losing it because he's not being a governor. He's out running for president. He's more concerned about what he needs to do to get the Republicans' interest, and those choices are really hurting us here in the state. Quite frankly, he created a $2.2 billion deficit, and he should be right here in our state helping us fix it because it's affecting Wisconsin families.
Now, in the last several years, there have been big changes in campaign finance reform. And looking ahead, do you see that as changing the calculus at all for turning over some of those seats that you're hoping to turn over next time around?
Well, I'm not a fan of having money in politics. I'm a supporter of Movement to Amend, and I really think that a lot of the problems that we have in politics have been created by money. But I would also say that, you know, that the changes that are occurring, you know, we're going to work with those changes. It's we have to stop complaining about what's happening and just work with as the game is current rules defined. So that's what we're going to do.
Now, looking ahead to 2016, Russ Feingold has announced that he'll be running against Ron Johnson for a rematch. And conventional wisdom says Democrats win bigger in Wisconsin in presidential election year. So what would you say about Russ Feingold's matchup with Ron Johnson coming up?
Well, I think Russ is going to do extremely well. I mean, I think Russ is a man who represents everyone. He cares about working people. He cares about our middle income and people living in poverty. He's out there working in the best interest of everyone. And I don't believe Ron Johnson's doing that at all.
Now, looking further down the road, looking at 2018, what should the Democratic Party consider in choosing a gubernatorial candidate to run?
Well, I think we should be looking at the array of great Democrats we have in the state, and we should be ensuring that we're getting someone who believes in that commitment to building strong communities, of ensuring that we have opportunity for all in fairness. And I think we have, I think you'll see over time that we're going to have several great candidates moving forward on that.
Any names you'd like to share?
Not at this time. Good try, though.
Well, so in the more immediate future, you're coming off a heated race to be chair of the party, and wondering how you plan to mend relations among party leaders in the state.
Do you know, I think that one thing that you can say about this race is that it showed that there are a lot of Democrats out there very excited about getting Wisconsin back on track, that we clearly all agree that we're going in the wrong direction. And so five candidates came forward to say they had a plan, and, you know, we built a lot of excitement in the party because of that. And what I'm doing is, you know, I've been reaching out to those candidates to tell them thank you for their service and for that they've already given, and that I would like to work with them to be sure that they stay very engaged in what we need to do, because we all believe that we want to get more Democrats in the Capitol. And we all had that same goal. And so I'm going to work together to reach out to them and make that happen.
Martha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
We've been talking to Martha Lanning, newly elected chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin.
Over the last couple of months, there have been plenty of major changes considered as part of the ongoing state budget process. The area facing maybe the biggest changes is K through 12 education.
From changes to voucher programs and standardized tests to the way teachers become qualified to teach, our next guest says Wisconsin is remaking the educational system, and it's not clear what the end result will be.
Joining us now is Alan Borsick. He's a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School. He writes a column about education for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Well, Alan, there's a lot to keep track of here, but you say maybe the biggest story and the biggest changes will come from a continuation of not increasing school funding, decreasing, no increases. Why is that the biggest deal?
Well, you could certainly make a case that a statewide voucher program is a big deal, and I'd make that a close second, shall we say, and maybe 10 or 15 years from now, I might reverse the two. Nonetheless, it's been really 6 years, going back to the last budget under Governor Doyle, actually, that there's been no significant increases in the amount of money available to public schools. And, of course, you factor in Act 10 when there was a decrease offset by some increased latitude for financial control for school districts. But nonetheless, the lid's been on for a long time, and now it's going to be on another 2 years. And you really have to ask, how long can you go without increasing spending at times when prices are going up for things as simple as utilities and busing costs and supplies? And it's not only the big ticket items like health insurance or raises to employees. How long can you go like this without really paying a price in what schools are able to do and what quality of education there is?
Are we starting to see those impacts yet in actually happening in the classroom?
Well, yes and no. I'd say no in the sense that I don't want to overstate the severity of things out there. I think just about every school in Wisconsin, including ones that are often labeled as low performing, is functioning on a day-to-day basis, and many of them are functioning very, very well. So you got to give a lot of credit to the overall quality of the public school system and in general, the education of K to 12 children in Wisconsin. But yes, the morale among teachers is poor. I think there's some real questions about who's going into teaching these days. Enrollment's down in teacher education programs around the state. I think you ask just about any school administrator or teacher if they're able to do some of the even smaller things they used to be able to do, school supplies and purchases of materials, or the number of adults in school, which is not a small thing, teachers' aides, safety aides, cafeteria staff. It isn't so much number of teachers as the number of adults in a school that have been reduced in many places. So, yeah, you're starting to see it. And I think the sense of unease in the public school sector particularly is very high, and that's true statewide. It's not just a Milwaukee thing.
And that's a point you raised, that there's starting to be pushback not just from maybe Madison, Milwaukee. There's pushback from suburban school administrators too.
Yes, I mean, it's very interesting to me. In the Milwaukee area, some of the most adamant advocacy for fighting budget cuts is coming from places like Wauwatosa, which of course is the home community of Governor Walker, from school districts like Elmbrook, which is Brookfield and Elm Grove, very well-to-do conservative areas. The superintendent of Kettle Moraine in Waukesha County, also very Republican-voting area, took part in a press conference last week opposing a flat budget picture for schools and said, the people in my district don't understand what this means. And that's pretty powerful thought. And I think you're seeing it more among parents and community groups and not just a small number of people. I think it struck a chord, which is why the Republicans rolled back the $127 million cut in education spending that the governor proposed.
And you said already voucher schools, the big expansion is the other of the big two stories here. What changes there?
Well, it's been 4 years now since the notion of expanding the voucher program beyond Milwaukee began, first in Racine with the 2011 budget, then in 2013 with a small statewide program, small in the sense that it was capped at 1,000 kids for this school year. And in this budget, and don't ask me why all these things are included in budgets and not in actual bills considered by public hearings and such, but in any case, in this budget, the doors open to vouchers statewide with a cap that eases every year for the next decade, and after a decade is eliminated. So you've got about 100,000 kids in Wisconsin going to private schools. What percentage of them would qualify for vouchers? Because there is an income limit that would be kind of middle class and lower. How many of those are going to be on public support of their education in private and religious schools is unknown, but now the door is really open to a huge change. People who've been warning that we're going to end up with two school systems, the public school system and the private school publicly funded system, and that the state can't afford both, they're really speaking up at this point saying, look, we told you this was coming, and you have to wonder again, how much are they on track with keeping the future in mind?
Alan, briefly, when we look back, you list some other things in a recent piece. Are we going to look back at 2015 and say this, for better or worse, was a turning point in Wisconsin education?
Well, I would emphasize the better or worse phrase because I don't want to take too strong a personal policy stand, but the simple answer is yes. There's stuff in this budget that is very momentous, keeping the lid on spending, the statewide vouchers, the changes in teacher licensing. There's a variety of the end of some long-time programs that were very popular, Chapter 220, voluntary racial integration, the not controversial but nonetheless very interesting more or less end of the SAGE program, reducing class sizes.
A lot there, Alan. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
There's a ton of stuff there, yeah.
Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the Wisconsin State Senate and Assembly were busy passing bills yesterday. We'll check in with WPR State Government Reporter on the latest news from the State Capitol building.
First, farmers markets are up and running all over Wisconsin and the nation now. Maybe you've already made a visit, picked up some seedlings, some rhubarb, some asparagus.
Well, our next guests say local farmers markets can bring benefits above and beyond the fresh local produce for communities and their economies. And they've been going around the country trying to help communities put some numbers on those benefits as part of the Farmers Market Metric Project.
Alfonso Morales is with us now from the UW-Madison. He's an associate professor of urban and regional planning. Alfonso, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Rob. I'm very pleased to be with you all today.
Lauren Seward is also working on the project. She's a PhD candidate in urban and regional planning at UW-Madison. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Alfonso, we talked to you back when you first kicked off this project. What kind of things are you trying to get at in this research about farmers markets?
Yes, you know, this has been an applied project. Our purpose is very, very much to empower market managers in collecting their own data, analyzing it, interpreting it, and reporting it to the folks that are most important in their jurisdictions, in their cities, in their towns, in their lives.
And Lauren, what kind of concrete things do you measure? I mean, there's a general sentiment about, oh, farmers market, that looked pretty busy today. How are you trying to put that in measurable terms?
Well, we track the number of visitors that attend on a regular basis, sales, vendor sales is a big one, SNAP and WIC, so how much sales they're doing in those areas.
Mm-hmm. And so what then do they do with this? So when this project is done, they know how to measure what they're doing. What do they get out of it?
Right. I think one of the very important things that the project has produced is a justification for why a market should collect data to address that question. And among those justifications are things like you want to collect data in order to help you determine what goals to make and how to determine decisions about the market, how to make decisions about the market in the context of what you actually know about the market, not just opinion. Mm-hmm. So opinion's important, politics are important, but hard data can inform both.
And Lauren, ultimately, does this help a farmer's market organizer, manager, whoever's in charge, sell what they're doing, sell the benefits to their community?
Yes, it helps with marketing, so getting them to attract more people to the market by showing that all the produce that they have available. It also helps prove they're worthwhile. They're an added benefit, added value to the community, so to their city representatives, stakeholders, partners, and then also helps them attract more funding to make them a more viable and livelihood.
Now, Alfonso, I'm going to ask you a question that I know you're actually trying to figure out the answer to in this research, but from what we know, what are the benefits to a local community, big or small, of having a farmer's market?
Sure. I think we can characterize those benefits in four big categories. One, there's benefits to the local political participation and social life of the community. Markets are places where people gather, they discuss the events of the day, they see friends and neighbors, they make new acquaintances, they resolve old differences. Markets serve many social and political functions. Of course, they have the economic functions that we've begun to discuss just a bit. They have an ecological impact. And this is something that's under debate, but it's an important question to address, which is, how is it that markets foster sustainability from an ecological point of view? How do they reduce the vehicle miles traveled, not just of consumers, but of producers? So benefits of those four categories are all important.
So economics, I can see how you put numbers on. A lot of those other things sound intangible. Have the two of you talked about how do you try to measure the civic impact, the first thing you mentioned, the community building impact?
So one of the things that we find in the markets is that all members of the project have visited markets in either recently or through the course of their experience. And from the project's perspective, one of the things that we're asking the market managers to do is respond to us every month with some information about what they've been doing in terms of data collection, in terms of what they've observed at the market. Another thing that we ask them to do is participate in a monthly call where they can impart stories about their activities to us. And we share those stories. Those stories are like pictures. They're worth 1,000 words, but their interpretations can vary depending upon who's seeing them. So we don't have, we don't try and reduce stories to numbers. But what we try and do is show how stories illustrate people's experience, how those stories help other people of very different personal experience or very different cities understand the same benefits that markets can have in their jurisdiction as they have in some other city.
Well, it seems like a good time to hear a story. One of the farmers markets that's part of your research, you've got ones around the country. I understand you're trying to get some going in Wisconsin added to the project, too. One is in Hernando, Mississippi, and we have Gia Matheny. She's involved in community development there and that market. Gia is on the line. Gia, hi.
Hi.
Well, tell us a little bit about your farmers market in Hernando, Mississippi, please.
Well, we're about 20 miles south of Memphis, and we are the largest farmers market in the state. And we differentiate ourselves because we are a Mississippi certified market, which means that the majority of our vendors at our market are agricultural producers. And we also go through an audit process with the Department of Agriculture each year to make sure that all of our producers are abiding by the cottage food laws, and they have the same strict requirements through the Department of Health. So we go above and beyond what some of the other markets in the state do.
Now, part of this research is trying to figure out, to help you figure out, the economic impact. But from where you're sitting, what's the value of your market for your local community there?
Well, I think a lot was said with Alfonso. I mean, there's more to the market than just fresh local food, which is our mission. But what we've heard from the patrons of the market is that they come there not only for the fresh food, but for the company, and they love to visit the crowds, the excitement of what's going on in the market. They see people that they only see at the market each week, and it becomes a friend of the week, and they see them each week, and they look forward to that experience.
And with this research, with what you're going to learn here, do you think you'll be better able to sell your community on those benefits?
Yes, I do. I don't think we've had a way to really capture that in numbers. And through this data collection project, I think we'll have something more substantial that we can communicate to our community.
Well, Gia, thank you so much for getting on the line with us today. That's Gia Matheny with the Farmers Market down in Hernando, Mississippi. We'll bring back in now Alfonso Morales and Lauren Seward. They're doing research on farmers markets and their impact around the country. So another one of those intangibles, Lauren. It's not just a place to buy produce. It's the place where you, and I've encountered this, experiences at farmers markets here in Wisconsin. That's the only place you see some people every week. How is that part of the value as you see it? Are you going to include this in the research somehow?
Well, we always strive to include those anecdotal components into the research. We're also trying to capture some of that through a little bit more data components by tracking the type of events that they host and the turnout, the numbers, participation in there. So we're trying to do well-rounded in terms of both anecdotal, value-added responses, and then supporting that up with more data.
And Alfonso, I mean, just in a short radius here, I can go to the Dane County Farmers Market, huge. Just a few weeks ago, I was at the Baraboo Farmers Market, just one block, eight or nine stands, I think. I mean, do these have value despite the size, regardless of size?
Yeah, I think it's clearly the case that here in Dane County, you can go to 30-odd markets in any given week. And whether they're small corner markets, 8 or 10 vendors, or 100 or 200 vendors, they all have value according to that scale. Farmers know that they want to make money. And they're not going to go if they don't think they're going to make money. So markets are sort of self-scaling. They're only going to grow insofar as they have demand for their produce. But I believe in Wisconsin and elsewhere that the reason why markets continue to grow is because the consumers interested in markets, those numbers are continuing to increase.
Now, you can see the obvious economic side of it. I, the consumer, go. I get some produce. The farmer, hopefully, is making money. I guess otherwise they wouldn't show up at the farmer's market. Is there spillover effect to the local economy beyond me handing the farmer some money, them handing me some lettuce?
Right. That's a very good question. There's been some data collection and some analysis of the economic contribution farmers make to local economies. Unfortunately, that data has been what we call cross-sectional. It's been one point in time. It hasn't been particularly robust. It was good enough to open the door for more analysis, but could have been stronger. So there are two things going on that we can take advantage of. One is this project. This project is a longitudinal project. So Rob, you no one will remember, but you and I will remember our conversation mm-hmm. last year. And next year, in the months ahead, you know, when we go into year three of the project next year, I look forward to chatting again about the preliminary economic analysis we have. But a second and important thing is that some markets have data they've collected on their economic impact and we have on their economic contribution. And I cannot tell you the numbers right now, but in a few days I will have completed a draft report from one of our markets that has 14 years of economic data from that market. And they did not know what to do with it. And it's just exciting for us to be playing with that data, especially in the context of large national level interest in the value of local and regional food economies.
We're talking about the benefits of local farmers markets with Alfonso Morales and Lauren Seward from UW-Madison. They're part of a project trying to help communities measure what they get out of their markets in terms of economic growth, community building, and more.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you buy or sell at a local farmers market? How important is it to your community, to your local economy, to your ability to get fresh produce? And what's the impact of your local farmers market? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about farmers markets and their impact on communities with Alfonso Morales and Lauren Seward with UW-Madison. They're helping communities put some numbers on the economic impact of their local markets.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What does your local farmers market mean to you? As a consumer, as a producer, what does it mean to your community? And is it that place where you run into those people in your community that you only run into at the farmer's market? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Oh, we'll go right to a caller. We've got Laura on the line in Dubuque. Laura, hi.
Oh, hi. So Dubuque Market is 170 years old. It's Iowa's oldest continuous outdoor market. We have about 110 vendors this year. And for some of our vendors, that 5 hours every Saturday morning is their only contact with their means of support for their whole operation for the rest of the year. And without having a market for them to bring their products to the public, they wouldn't be a small business owner. So it's extremely important for our community to be able to have a market and for them to bring their products to consumers.
Laura, thanks so much for the call. Alfonso, you were nodding along there.
Laura, you put it so well. It is so important for folks to keep connected to the source of their food. And, you know, people nowadays celebrate that as the new thing. But folks like you, and, you know, I was raised on a farm ranch operation myself, those of us who come from agriculture recognize very well the importance of that connection and understanding the value of their work to the communities that they're part of. And I just thank you for putting it so well.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. Well, she mentioned the sources of our food, and we hear talk about things like food deserts or lack of access to healthy foods. Lauren, are farmers markets part of that puzzle, giving people access to healthier eating?
That's what we're trying to find out. It is a great way to connect with the city in different ways, just because it is an informal environment, and they can be in different locations throughout the community, and people can walk there, they can drive there. So trying to figure out how they're getting there is a big component of our research. And then also figuring out what they're buying and what they're buying the most of. So,
You know, just to tag on to that and how they're buying, one of the great things is that many markets, including the Dane County Farmers Market, but many markets around the country allow folks on supplemental nutrition who have SNAP benefits to double the value of those benefits at farmers markets. So a person with $5 worth of benefits can buy $10 worth of produce, and markets around the country operationalize that in a number of interesting ways. Here in Dane County, we've done some work recently about how to enhance those opportunities for low-income consumers.
Go back to our callers now as we talk about the impact of farmers markets with Alfonso Morales and Lauren Seward. We have Michael on the line now in New Berlin. Michael, hi.
Hi. Thanks for being here for us. I really appreciate you and love your show.
Thanks.
We have a farmers market in New Berlin that we go to every Saturday that we can as part of our Saturday ritual. During the summer, we get up, take the dogs for walks, stop by the market, see what's there, what's fresh. We talk to people, and they know us. They know our golden doodle and our standard poodle, and we walk through there, and it's just a wonderful way to connect with your community, get fresh produce, fresh products, and to kind of catch up in a community way to help your local community and help yourself to great products.
And, Michael, I am sure you see your neighbors there. Are you on a first-name basis now with the farmers who are selling there?
With several that we are. Several of them, they know us. We've actually had one of the farmers have brought their dogs. They have poodles as well, standard poodles, to our backyard and played with them. So they've come to our house, and it's like a family affair. It's wonderful.
Michael, thank you so much for sharing that story. A weekly ritual for him. Are the two of you in the data you're helping farmers markets collect, are you distinguishing between the Michaels of the farmers market world who are there every week versus the unique visitors? Or is there any way to even track that?
We try. Uh-huh. So we'll find out whether we can. But basically, the best way to do it is just by talking to the visitors that are there, whether that's informally or through more of a formal survey.
And that formal survey that Lauren's referring to is a first-time visitor survey. Several of the markets that we're working with do select one of the metrics to try and determine who's new at their market. So the markets that we're working with are collecting data on four common metrics. And then, of the 37 in total that we've developed, they can elect several others to collect data on. And first-time visitor is one of those metrics.
All right, Michael, thanks a lot. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking for your experiences of farmers markets. What do you think the value of your local farmers markets is to you, to your community? We go now to Robert in La Crescent. Robert, hi.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. We spend our winters in Florida and, of course, our summers up in La Crescent, Minnesota. But I find a great benefit to the consumer is the variety of vegetables that are available at the farmer's market and the quality. Of course, quality is number one. Today, when you go to an average store, you're dealing with these big conglomerates, and they have their specific suppliers all around the world, whether they're Ecuador or you name where. And they take whatever quality, not that they really evaluate it and pass inspection on it, don't get me wrong, but let's say as an example, in green onions in Florida, you can't get a decent-sized green onions because they buy them from one supplier, and the size of them are about a quarter inch in diameter. And I keep asking, why can't you get good quality green onions? Well, our supplier doesn't provide these for us. And that's the answer you would get from a conglomerate, where you can go to a farmer's market and you can basically get what you want.
Robert, thanks a lot for that call. Alfonso, do you think this is driving what seems to me to be a growth in interest in farmers markets, this desire among consumers to have that stuff that is fresh, so what they perceive as and maybe really is higher quality stuff?
Yeah, I think Robert really put his finger on it there. You know, 50 years ago, the food system produced relatively homogenous products. Everybody had pretty much the same thing and had kind of forgotten what their grandparents and parents had available to them. But we did. In the early 1970s, with the Dane County Farmers Market, the Berkeley Farmers Market in 1968, the Dane County in 72, those were harbingers. They started reintroducing folks to the value of locally produced food, to the diversity of that food. And so for the last 30 years, we've just seen increasing interest in that. And for reasons Robert puts, you know, the quality of the produce, how one can select exactly what they're getting, and what Michael and Laura pointed out, the relationships and whatnot. These callers are all identifying facets of markets that we're equally interested in.
And Lauren, I know part of the research is hoping to help markets market themselves to consumers. Mm-hmm. From what you've heard from people running these markets, are they using this as a selling point, this desire for more fresh, higher quality produce, or are they seeing a potential to do that?
They already are. So they do a lot with Facebook, social media, and then they are also, so they're doing it at this point, and then we're also developing the hard data for them to really tangibly support that.
So I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about farmers markets in Wisconsin. You've referred to them some. Your research is nationwide. It seems to me, being in Wisconsin, that this is a big farmers market state. Do we, from what we know, do we have more farmers markets, more interest in farmers markets in Wisconsin, Alfonso?
Yes, it's interesting to point out that other research another student has done, Annie Roy Ball, who's now working at the University of Arizona, a student who I was fortunate enough to be associated with. Her work on farmers markets in the state shows that the USDA count of farmers markets is about 20% short of the actual number of farmers markets in the state. So right off the bat, there's an undercount from a national level perspective. And second of all, her work was particularly interested in public health benefits of farmers markets, something we have not even touched on but could rehearse for at great detail. Here in Wisconsin, concern with both of those things is we're at the front of the nation in that regard.
So if, I don't know if you want to be too much of an advocate here, but if there are local planners, community leaders out there thinking of starting farmers markets, trying to boost what they have locally, can you make the case that, yeah, they should go ahead and do that?
Yes, but I would also suggest that they're the best observers of their local circumstances. You know, here at the university and at the system schools around the state, part of our job is to support them in evaluating their, and so that's what we're here to do.
And Lauren, this project is going, just entering year two right now. How long is this intended to go on for?
Well, we have one more pilot year, and then we hope to be able to scale up our data collection instruments and the whole everything about our project up to more of like a national scale and make it available to a wider audience.
So this is going to be groundbreaking. There's not a lot of data out there about farmers markets when it comes down to it.
No, unfortunately not. And the USDA last did a systematic enumeration in 1918.
1918.
So
nice,
yeah.
Almost 100 years.
Almost
probably up
years.
To date. All right. Well, Alfonso, thank you so much for coming up.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure.
Lauren, thanks to you. That was Alfonso Morales, Associate Professor of Urban and Regional Planning, and Lauren Seward, PhD candidate in Urban and Regional Planning. They're both at UW-Madison. We've been talking about their research on the impact of farmers markets.